Hi, my name is Duncan, and I'm an alcoholic. I've made a note. It only has three words on it, so it'll be a very short talk, I think. This week I've been working on the sweater prayer. I'm not so concerned with what I have to say in front of people, but sometimes what I'm going to wear is more important to me. And I find the more I worry about that, the more God takes care of other things. And the sweater prayer goes something like this. God grant me the sweater to accept the things I cannot change, the caffeine to change the things I can, and the wellness to accept the difference. This morning, out of the blue, a little cash windfall came into my hands that I wasn't expecting from home, and I had enough money to buy that sweater. But I said, I don't want it, because it's not going to change anything about me at this moment. It's not a solution. I decided instead to close my eyes and just take what came first. The shirt was a gift from a sponsee several years ago. He bought it for himself and couldn't wear it in public. So he knew I could. A large part of my story is the richness of things that people have brought into my life, as opposed to the wealth of things that my own mind has created for me. I've become open to acceptance of the kindness of others, as opposed to me manipulating people to get those things that I want. So much of my story is quite ordinary. I think one of the things that people often find so dismaying about me is that I don't suffer. And without a certain amount of suffering in your life, people aren't drawn to you. But I've refused to take on any more suffering in order to draw people to me. I allow myself to be me. So I come from an intact, whole family. There was no, as I can recognize it yet today, dysfunction in my family. I'm from a 5% of people whose families were, in fact, functional. I have a brother and two sisters. My father traveled a great deal in my youth across Canada, finally settling in Nova Scotia, in Cape Breton, to be more precise, if people want to really know where, from Sydney, in fact. Then you might know my dad. He was a manager for a cemetery there and eventually knew everybody in town. And I guess one of the threads of my sense of being different from other people was whenever I had to tell people what my father did for a living, it separated me from them, because it was just a bit unusual, a bit macabre, because most of the other families there worked at the steel plant, or something of that nature, whereas I had that as my background. I spent all my younger years, even in adolescence, teenage years, thinking I was adopted, or if I didn't, I pretended I was. Even though I'm almost like a clone of my father physically, I didn't think I belonged there. I didn't think I belonged on this planet. I found it almost impossible to integrate myself with people around me, with the other kids. It was hopeless. I tried all sorts of things, most of them that involved manipulating them, because I figured that's how you got along with people. They did what you wanted them to do. It never worked, and nobody could do the reverse to me either. I would never do what people wanted me to do, but that was because I was so contrary. So my childhood was like that. My parents loved me. They didn't spoil me. They didn't deprive me. They gave me the opportunity to own myself. I never felt obligated to fulfill my parents' dreams for me. They let me find my own dream and follow it. you know, and I'm very grateful for that. You know. I slept walk through high school. I did a bit of college. At a very young age, I knew that I was a little queer boy. One of my earliest memories of men was it was when we lived in Manitoba. At least I think this is when it was. I was about 4 or 5. And we were at some campground, and there were guys, older guys, taking showers. It was sort of a semi-outdoor shower, and I kept thinking I'd like to go in there and help them wash their backs. It was just something about the hair on their bodies and the soap that I knew I wanted, but I didn't know at that age just what it might be. When I was old enough to realize it, I also realized just what our culture thought of that kind of behavior. And it became a secret that everybody knew. One of those, but it also a secret that I didn't know how to deal with. I didn't know what to do with it. You know, some of my early drinking was getting drunk with some of my good friends, and suddenly our clothes would be off, and we'd be doing things, and we'd be saying, "Oh, in the morning," that kind of stuff. Exploring, and it was all, as I look back now, very innocent. But at that time, I felt that it wasn't so innocent. It was just another one of the ways that I was misunderstood or could never be understood or never could be accepted. Also, at a very early age, I started writing and painting, doing everything I could that God brought into my life to express myself. Because I didn't know how to, I couldn't figure out a way of communicating to people or wanting to communicate with them. I didn't know what I had to say or what happened, you know, so I didn't. And I'm grateful that I didn't get boxed in as a total introvert. You know, I did have a form of expression, and in whatever wellness I have, a lot of it comes out of that fact that I never got completely trapped in my own head. After a bad year at college, and that's when my drinking started, I was a blackout drinker from the start. Even before I started drinking, I thought this is how people drank. You know, you drink, you blackout, you don't remember what you did. When I qualify, often I say, if I could remember what I did the night before, I did not have a good time. You know, I always drank, it started out as like once a month, once every 2 months, and it quickly built up to once a week. I could never drink enough at one time. I would drink and throw up and drink and throw up. I just couldn't stop. When I started, I went from the sort of the personality change. I went from somebody who was mildly nasty to somebody who was unrepentantly vicious when I drank. So it was from like was it Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? It was from Mr. Hyde to less than hidden. I was not a nice person. I'm probably not as bad as I think I was. Which is a part, I think, of our disease that it's so easy to exaggerate the way we were, you know, but I know I wasn't nice. The other thing that came into my life at a very early age was music, and I am still, my life has a constant soundtrack. You know, the first thing that goes on in the morning after I say my first set of prayers is a tape deck or a CD. There's music instantly. You know, I can't conceive of a life without it, as I can't conceive of a life without this program of recovery in it. Those are two of the three or four things that have been constants in my life. Recovery for the last about 17 years, and music for the past 300. As some of you may know, I work in live theater. I'm a director, and a show that we just did was about people obsessed with music, and one of the characters says about music, and his particular obsession was opera, but I don't think it matters what it is. But he says, opera is the one thing in life that does not reject me. And for me, music was the one thing at all times that would never reject me. And I think that's why it became so important to me. In my early 20s, I got a job with famous players down east. I stuck in with them for about 10 years. My drinking escalated and escalated and escalated. By the end of my drinking, I was someone who wanted to wake up dead. I was also someone who had successfully exhibited paintings and sold them, someone who had been published and had gotten good reviews, someone who had several very good and reasonably rewarding friendships with people, someone who had all of those things that life tells me will make me feel whole and complete and happy. And I just wanted to drink myself to death and would often wake up quite disappointed that I was still alive. Looking back on it now, I realize that it was because those things aren't designed to do what we're told they're designed to do. You know, it's nice to have those things, but those things, whatever that hole is here, those things aren't designed to fill it. You know, they can decorate it, but they don't fill it. Towards the end of my drinking, I was doing anything I could to control it except not drink. Even those times when I would go for a couple of weeks, maybe, without drinking, it was so that the next time I had that first drink, it would have a punch because it had stopped losing its impact on me. I'd started mixing all my drinks at once. I would have, like, this huge gallon jug, and I would put in the, depending on whatever I was having, one of the things I was fond of was what I called well-screwed drivers, which would be some orange juice, some vodka, and some triple sec orange liqueur, and I would shake it up so that it all stayed the same strength as I drank them, because I would just make them stronger and stronger. I would have something somewhere in my apartment, and they would start getting stronger and stronger. You know, towards the end of my drinking, I drank sitting on the floor because I had a coordination problem. And just about everything I needed was within my reach, my telephone, my stereo, you know, the 7 or 8 or 10 albums I thought I would want to listen to that night, everything so that I wouldn't have to. I found a bucket that was the exact height of my bed so that when I started vomiting, I wouldn't have to move. I just roll over. It would be there. I could roll back. I thought I was so lucky. I started having hallucinations. I had physical hallucinations of when I would lie in the bed, I would feel people sitting on the edge of the bed or moving it, and there'd be nobody there. Darn. I was starting to have auditory hallucinations. I would hear music coming through the walls. I would hear people across the street talking about me. I would hear telephones ringing. I was having visual hallucinations in which I would see things out of the corner of my eye darting somewhere. And I had emotional hallucinations. Waiters or waitresses who would be kind to me in bars obviously wanted to see me later. That kind of total, you know, loss of contact with any kind of reality. Or even if they were mean to me, you know. It was obvious something was happening here, you know. I was a mess. I didn't connect any of the things in my life, any of the problems, life problems I was having with alcohol. They were all people, places, and things. It was because I was living in this little hick town on the East Coast. I was so unhappy. I had no community. I had nobody to relate to. The people at work didn't appreciate the work I did for them. You know, all of this. I never saw the connection between my drinking and my emotional state. The vomiting, well, it was pretty obvious to me that was connected, that I started to enjoy that, you know. Because if you can't stop it, you might as well enjoy it, you know. During one of my last bouts of drinking, I had a copy of The Body Politic because I'd started to find out about the gay community, and I was getting it. It eventually became Extra. It was a newspaper printed here in Toronto, and the back of it was the phone numbers for different organizations, and And coincidentally, one of those organizations had a member of the program in it. And talking to him on the phone, and I was just breaking open my next 40-ounce or something, and he realized that I was just completely drunk. And he sent me some more information. He sent me something about this program, and I looked at it and said, people, places, and things, and just tossed it over my shoulder. You know, actually, I think I hid it. I was afraid someone would see this. Because not only did it say that I was an alcoholic, or could be, but it also said gay and homosexual. And even though I was getting drunk and coming out to people, I didn't want them to see the see it in print. You know, it was very odd, whatever the shame issue around that was. But when I moved here, I got in touch with him. He took me to my first meeting. You know, I didn't come here looking for what I have today in the way I have it. I certainly didn't come to my first year of recovery looking for recovery. I didn't come to AA looking for recovery. I came because this was a place this guy was going to take me. And I thought, oh yeah, well, we'll see. What else was there for me to do between the hours of like 7 and 10 anyway on a Friday night before I went to a bar? You know, so I went to meetings. Yeah, and I went to meetings and I went to meetings and I'm still going to meetings. You know, message to the newcomer, go to meetings. You know, it's as simple as that. After about a year or so of meetings, my life began to change. The job that I'd had for about, I guess at that point, 10 years, that evaporated. I just couldn't fit into the way things were done here in Toronto, so be it. You know, God looks after me, he was then, he does today, you know. And I think that was my first experience in complete surrender, and my experience of the results of surrender. And my experience in seeing that all of those things that I thought, the job, the XXX, were those things that would do it for me, is that what would do it for me would be the surrender to whatever was offered to me. And that's what the answer for that day would be. And so I haven't had a paycheck now in about 15 years. It might be longer. I sort of lose track of time, fortunately. But I'm not starving. You know, I have sponsees who give me fabulous clothes every now and then. You know, I trust almost implicitly in what the will of my higher power is for me today, you know, and all of that I have discovered and experienced here, sometimes directly in my own life, but sometimes by witnessing in other people's lives, you know. God has made me lazy enough that I don't want to go through what you've gone through. No thanks, honey. I'm not going to have a slip to go through what you went through. I know it'll happen to me, and I'm not going to do it, you know. And I'm grateful for all of those things. You know, the journey of my recovery has been probably more interesting to me and more astonishing than the process of my being a drunk. You know, if there's anything unusual about me becoming a drunk is that I don't have any of the classic markers of being an alcoholic. It's not in my family of origin. It's not in my grandparents on either side. You know, it was God dropping that into my life. I sometimes suspect that if I hadn't been drinking the way I did during those formidable years of my life, I might have killed myself, because I don't think I could have emotionally or spiritually coped with some of the conflicted pain of growing up gay in a small town and all sorts of other confusing stuff that was going on. You know, I was suicidal enough as it was. I'm sure if I'd been drinking, I probably would have. If I hadn't been drinking, I would have done it. So in a rather ironic way, alcohol saved my life and also gave me a life. It wasn't until I'd been in this program maybe 5 years before I could honestly say that I'm an alcoholic. I would say it just so people wouldn't try to tell me I was one or try to convince me of things that I didn't need to be convinced of. You know, because language was my addiction, I certainly knew how to say the right things at the right times to keep people at the right distance from me, or sometimes to keep them in kind of awe of me. I don't know if I'm grateful for that or not, but that's the way it was. You know, at about the 5-year point, I realized, yes, I am an alcoholic. The fog had lifted sufficiently that I was able to see in other people's lives those things that were in my life that I didn't see or didn't recognize at the time. The nature of despair and denial and alienation that I had a sense of, I was able to admit and address in my life. It wasn't until I hit the 10-year point that I realized that this program is my life. You know, for a long time, recovery was something that I was doing until my real life started. You know, this is what I'll be doing now until Mr. Dubinsky calls and says, I've got this project for you. You know, this is my life. And it is not only is it the firm bedrock, as they say in step one of the 12 and 12, but it's also not only the bottom line, but the top line. Nothing I do or would want to do is more important to me than continuing my recovery. Nothing I do or would want to do can take the place of my recovery. I would much rather be at my meeting on a Thursday afternoon than taking lunch with anyone, and have in fact done that 3 or 4 times, sometimes to my detriment, in a professional way, but in an emotional, spiritual way, who needs it? You know, this is what I need, and this is where I get what I need. So many astonishing things have fallen into my life that would never have happened, or if they did, I wouldn't have been able to live through them, to walk through them, to be aware of them, to recognize them, let alone experience them. One of the things, I can't prioritize them because there have been so many different things, but one thing that had a really profound influence on the direction of my recovery is a fair length of time that I spent in the Al-Anon program, which gave me the key to detachment. Frequently loving detachment, but with a bite. Because I don't bite people I don't love, you know, because I don't care. But the people I care for, I'm very strong and very I think intimate with, but also I don't put up with bullshit, you know. And it's only through learning detachment from myself as well, and from my expectations of other people that I was able to acquire through the time that I spent in Al-Anon, that I've been able to actually interact with people. You know, all of those problems of interaction that I brought with me as a child and as an adult, I was able to solve through the process of the 12 steps. You know, and I'm grateful for that. You know, I learned that I'm what I often call the limits of love. I bought almost wholeheartedly this illusion that love conquers and changes everything. And when I entered into a relationship with another alcoholic and my love for that person didn't conquer, change, cure, heal, or do anything, I thought there was something wrong with me. There was something wrong with him that I could conquer, cure, or change. Through the sheer willpower, I discovered that all love does is survive and makes me comfortable with myself. But if it doesn't do anything for you, I still have my ability to love you. You know, there's nothing wrong with my ability to love if it doesn't cure, conquer, or change you. You know, I think that it's mother, manager, and marker is another set of terms for that sort of thing. I didn't cause it, I can't cure it, and it's not my fault that I can't. At one time I thought it was my fault, you know, but now it's not. God is the only person I know who can work in other people's lives the way he has in mine. It was very tough giving up the illusion that love conquers everything, because I so much wanted to believe that it did. And there's still times when I wish it would. You know, there are still times when I wish that the love that I may have for somebody could reach into their brain and just soothe that little thing that keeps fucking them around the corner, so that they could have some sense of calm, but it can't. You know, and of the two or three things in my life that can still give me some kind of emotional, spiritual pain is the limit of what love can do for you, or the limit of what my love can do for you. The sponsorship is very crucial to my recovery. I've got several incredible sponsees. My relationships with them aren't the ones at work aren't casual. They're very intense. They're emotional. Very enmeshed. Sometimes very brutal. And I do brutality thoughtlessly because it's good for me and it's good for them, and can also take it as well as dish it out. One of the things about sponsorship that I find most rewarding is that I can see those things that work in my recovery work in theirs. That my recovery is not so unusual or so distinct that those things that work for me will only work for me, but they can and do work for other people. My relationship with my sponsor is equally as intense, and he is equally as brutal with me when necessary. And we spend a lot of time laughing about our lives and the way we take ourselves so importantly in our lives. Because it was important for me to have a sponsor I could laugh with, because I cried long enough in my beer. I don't want to do it into my coffee here, you know. So I have a sponsor who shares a lot of the same humor that I share as well, which helps. The program has given me the ability to be responsible for myself. You know, when I first heard the 12 promises, or the 12 threats, as I often think of them, having a lot of those things in my life just terrified me. You know, we will intuitively know what to do in situations that just baffle us. Well, I've always known what to do in a situation that baffles me. Here, you fix this. Yeah, you do something. You know, I wasn't there. Oh, I didn't understand you. Today, I do know intuitively what to do, and I willingly do it myself. You know. But I didn't learn. I learned that by making coffee at meetings, by saying, "Okay, I'll be there at 6:30, and I will plug it in, and I will set up the meeting. And when we were smoking, I will clean those fucking ashtrays." It meant that I would get to meetings on time. When I said I would be there, I would be there. I couldn't say, "Oh, I forgot," you know, and get away with it. And it paid off in teaching me how to be responsible and how to accept responsibility and how to say no to it when I was sick and tired of doing it. Sitting at business meetings and often in discussion meetings taught me how to listen to what people had to say, how not to take things personally, that if somebody didn't think we needed decaf at our meeting, that it wasn't because they hated my fucking guts. It was because they just didn't think that we needed it, you know, and I just said, okay, and get over myself, you know. I learned to, if I was going to make suggestions of things to do, that I better be willing to do it. You know, if I think this would make our meeting so much better, then I'd better stay a member of that group long enough to make sure that it happens and not make the suggestion and quit 2 months later because nobody's doing it. You know, is that, and not to take those things personally. You know, this is the way life happens. You know, I don't in any way now judge the way things happen. I hear people often say shit happens. Well, that's pretty harsh. I think that's too harsh for me. I don't think of anything in my life like that. I just think this is the way life happens. You know, if you can't stand the heat, you stay out of the kitchen. And this is what happens. You know, and I, through the grace of God, can live very comfortably with the way things happen. I may not like them, but I can live with them. You know, and in our lives today, there are so many things we do not like. one of the things that that's also been a main, a major, I don't know, issue. One of the this had a profound effect on my recovery is HIV, and I'm one of those people who's merely been an observer and don't carry the antibody in my me. But when it first started happening to friends of mine, or not quite that, friends of friends of mine, and then closer, and watching how it was demolishing people's lives, I began to get quite angry that nobody was doing anything. But what I wanted was, of course, intuitively knowing, is that I wanted somebody else to do something, so that I wouldn't have to do anything, so that I wouldn't have to experience or watch this going on. So I became active within the AIDS community here for 3 or 4 years, got quite up, and then, as frequently happens, cycled out so that other people could come in as well. I was on the home care team for several people. I was sort of remembering some of them just this past week, partly because a couple of them were very involved in what we have today. You know, and reading the little introduction in here talking about the first gratitude 17 years ago, which I was at, and I don't know if anybody else here that I can see was actually there. If you were, raise your hand. I guess not. One of the organizers was a man, Gus B., Gus Brzezanski. Now that he's passed on, we can break his anonymity. Gus, the first time I met him, looked like a bad drag queen with a really horrible rinse job. He was a chef who could get things done and did things with amazing love and brutalness. Boom, boom. He didn't mess around with people. He did the first gratitude dinner. He saw that the second one happened. You know, he passed away 2 or 3 years ago. And it was a little heartbreaking to see that happen. Another member who I want to just mention now is Ed Eyre, whose anniversary was about this time of the year as well, who became a very dear, close friend of mine. He used to do my head at one time. And was also one of the first people who I met, and maybe the only person I met in this program, who actually came from my hometown, and whom also is grateful that I never drank with him. I would have been very strange. But he left town before I even started drinking, so there you go. But he was one of the men who kept me coming back, because he had a power of life in him and a willingness to be who he was that gave me permission to be who I was, you know. And when I got to know him towards the end of his life, I discovered that I also gave that to him, that we were sort of feeding off of each other's decisions and the way God was carrying each of us through our different lives, that it gave each of us the willingness to continue something that was very frightening and to experience things that were very frightening. I don't think I could have experienced the death of these dear friends without this program. I would have run. I would have drank myself to death. I would have numbed myself out. I just could not have done that. You know, it just and to sit there and watch people, as I used to think of it, be erased in front of me. You know, it's not any easier today, but I have a greater acceptance and not as much anger as I used to have. But I still have another great area of anger in my life is around that whole thing. You know. And also because I can't do anything to stop it. Another thing that's very crucial to my recovery is meetings. Even after this length of time, I get to 4, maybe 5 meetings a week. I make them a priority. I don't miss them unless I have to, unless I'm sick, or unless I've got a show on and I have to be there. And even then, I try to make sure somebody else is there so that I can get to my meetings, because without them, I don't know where I would be today. Frequently I go to meetings and I look around and think, oh God. And look at my watch and, oh, I want to get out of here. What am I doing with these people? You know, I feel nothing. I'm getting nothing. But what I'm getting is my subconscious being willing to be there. I'm getting another affirmation of just the humbling experience that the magic in this program is being where you don't want to be listening to a speaker you don't want to hear. And that will keep me well. You know, and to continue doing it without knowing what it's going to be. I have two home groups. I guess I needed them. I've got my downtown group, Eventide, is one of the as a gay group, and I have a what passes as a straight group in the East End. But well, any group that one of us is at is no longer straight. You know. And there are a couple of other gay members of that group now as well. So I'm not sort of out on my own in this wilderness of rednecks by any means. Yeah. I'm going to recount a couple of things that have happened in my life in the last few weeks, because sometimes it's easier for me to understand how the program works by just talking about what's happened to me and how I've dealt with it. And I don't know what step this is, or I don't know what tradition covers that, but I know that this program has allowed me to be there to go through this. I've just closed a very emotionally difficult piece of theater. Difficult for me, difficult for the people who were in it. Not merely difficult because of the text, which was hard enough, but because one of the cast, after 2 weeks of the run, decided to go. And it took me like 2 seconds to decide what to do. And I picked up the phone and I called someone and said, would you like to try this? You won't have any time to rehearse, you won't have any time to research, but I'll give you a text and you can walk on stage and do it. I knew who exactly to call and who would say yes, and he said yes. You know, what I did not do was go to this guy who was leaving the show and run any numbers on him. I just said, okay, if this is your decision, then we can go on without you. And I let him go without, as it says in one of the steps, the need to run from the situation or to recriminate. Because I've discovered God gets even in ways that are much crueler. You know, and all of the cast, none of us was happy that the situation had happened. But doing anything that would have been vengeful or trying to teach him a lesson would have only made things worse. They would not have made things better. You know, and even trying to convince him not to do it would not have made things better. And I don't know if this is a defect or not, but I think I have too much pride to do that. That I don't have to beg people to work with me or beg people to stay. If they want to, they will. If they're staying because they've been begged to, they're not going to do the job I want anyway. You know, and the person who came in was so willing and so eager and so cooperative, and the show got twice as good, partly because of that. It created a great strain for everybody else in the cast, just to go through that. And I think one of the reasons they were able to do it was because I was so calm, and that I was just so willing to look for a solution to keep things going forward in the direction that we had all wanted it to go forward in. The day after he told me he was leaving, another member of the cast said, you know, I don't think I can finish the run. So what I did was, and he told me this like 5 minutes before curtain. So once the curtain got up, I went and I phoned my sponsor. And I laid out the few things that had happened. The first guy is gone, good riddance. The second guy is now. And I'm thinking maybe this is what I should do, or maybe I should try this. So my sponsor suggested that I agreed with what I would like to do. You know, and I did it. And so he stayed. You know, none of the other cast knew that this was happening, simply because they would have gone ballistic. The stress of one was enough, but another we would have had to have closed the show. It would have been helpful. We couldn't have continued. And we would have faced that consequence, but I didn't want to. You know, I did what was an ethical and non... I didn't put a gun to anybody's head. I just said, this is what will happen if you leave the show. and he didn't leave the show. I think he also knows what God's revenge can be like and didn't want to incur that wrath either. But I was able to walk through that. You know, I didn't have to, I didn't panic. I didn't have anxiety attacks. I didn't do any of those things that I might have done that would numb me. I didn't go someplace and have two double espressos so that I could think clearly and quickly. You know, I'd go someplace and have like a pita, because there's lots of restaurants around, you know, because in past times I've done things like gone and overeat, you know, a lot of ice cream or something just to numb, just to get me through this or to give me a quick rush. And I just said, no, I can walk through this. You know, if I can have a dear friend die in my arms, I can walk through this with the same kind of what I call elegance. And one of the things that also helps me with this is that when I talk about these things afterwards, I want to talk about having walked through them well. You know, it's knowing that I will eventually share the things in my life that, in a way, makes me go through them with sometimes more compassion for myself and others than I naturally have. Yeah, and that comes from here, and only from here. This program it has been miraculous in my life. I came here as somebody who needed this, but didn't even know what he needed. You know, I sort of walked out of a hole in the fog, and suddenly I was here looking at all of these cute guys, and I kept coming back hoping I'd meet one of them somehow. And that never really quite happened. I came here having left all my friends behind, and discovered once you put the cork in the bottle, you often put your cork in old friendships too. So, good riddance, and God love them. I have experienced and been given all of the things in my life that I imagined I would get as an alcoholic. That I thought somehow being at the right smart party, drinking with the right smart people, saying the right smart vicious things, these things would happen to me. You know, that my sheer willpower would make these things happen to me, my magnetism. But it hasn't been. You know, it has been by being here, by being willing to be here. I have an enormous life today. I think one of the reasons that I walk through what I do is because my life isn't one step, the 12 steps. My life isn't one thing, but many things. I know the less I have in my life, the more I get upset about those few things not being perfect. But the more things I have in my life, the more happy I am with all of them, and I don't care about perfection because it's such a responsibility. I generally end with a little thing out of the big book, but there isn't one here. I'll see if I can remember it. It's on page 100. It's the only page number I can quote, fortunately. And it goes something to the effect that as you walk this journey, you will be amazed at the things that come into your life. Quite often, they may not be what you expect, but they will always be better than those things that you wished for yourself. I could never have wished this kind of a life for myself. I don't think I could have ever experienced the kind of love that I experienced, and even sometimes because of the way alcohol has damaged me, but I do experience it. You know, it's for people who are having a hard time or are having a good time or who are still on cloud nine, keep coming back. You can't keep what you've got if you're not here. It can't get better if you're not here. I don't deny that people outside of these programs, outside of these walls, can be happy and content with their life. But they won't have what this program can bring to them if they're not here to get it. You know, and I'm so grateful that I'm here to get it. And I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to share that. Thanks very much.